Access number 28678, Mr. Dermot Rhodes, Reel 14. Now, I think the next point we're going on to is when you were on a fishery protection detachment. Now, this is actually on the Jaguar. Is it, or what's the name?
Yes, that's correct. It was Jaguar. And it was really to finish my time or to complete the 6 months detachment I had. And we were sent up to do some distant water fishery protection patrol duties up inside the Arctic Circle.
Now, what was this like?
Well, it was a fascinating time. I've been up in northern waters before, but never on a prolonged detachment. And the thing that really struck me about being so far north was the fact that the weather can change so quickly. One minute you're in cloudy, clear blue sky, sunshine, sea for miles, and almost with a minute or so, you've got a blizzard and you can hardly see the bow of the ship. And no matter what the weather forecast was, you had to be ready for these changes of weather, which were very significant when it came. Most of your duty was keeping an eye on mainly our deep-sea fishing trawlers to give them assistance, to provide them with advice, to protect them, really, if anything untoward happened. And we did this. We had these small, fast, semi-rigid boats we used to send over there. And it could be very easy in these blizzards or whatever to lose the boat and the trawler we were looking after. So one had to be fairly careful and fairly circumspect about how you detached your limited forces. And we provided medical assistance, mechanical assistance, advice on legal aspects. If there were any problems with other trawlers crowding them, we used to keep an eye and maintain a presence. We occasionally used to go into the North Norwegian ports, Hardanger, Harstad, Tromsø, just for a few days, maybe to refuel or replenish our victuals, but not for very long before we came out again. The other problem being in very, very northern latitude is that that fact has a major effect often on your radio communications and on your compass. For instance, a magnetic compass seems to go mad up in the northern latitudes. And so you have to be very careful with your navigation as well. But all went well, and we suffered no mechanic problems at all. And it was a very, for me, illuminating, interesting, and happy time. I had an excellent ship's company, and we completed our distant water fishery protection patrol, and then came back to this country for a short time in our base port in Chatham, I think it was then. And then, lo and behold, at the other side of the coin, we were sent off to for our final detachment to be the guardship at Gibraltar. That was an occasion when we were not on terribly good terms with the Spaniards with regard to Gibraltar, politically speaking, and the border was closed. And each of the countries sent a frigate or that size to have a permanent presence. Anyway, we went down there and...
Now, what was it like? What were you doing there?
We used to keep an eye on the Spanish frigate, and we used to go out and again maintain a presence. We used to go out to the edge of territorial waters in Gibraltar Bay. We used to patrol the straits from time to time. There are always interesting ships going in and out of the straits, and I'm talking mainly about Russian or Soviet vessels going in and out. We keep an eye on or any warships. Just to watch who was there and report back. And then we did occasional employment. We actually acted as flagship to the flag officer Malta, the admiral there, for an official visit to Casablanca, which was, again, extremely interesting.
And what do you remember of it?
Well, the main thing I remember is I accompanied the admiral when he arrived on his calls, his official calls, and he was calling on some official in the Royal Palace, at some fairly senior minister. And I remember going in full ceremonials, we used to call them ice cream suits, but swords and medals and everything else together, and walking up seemingly endless flights of steps to the receiving room, flanked by we used to call them Janissaries, but they were sort of Arab warriors with huge curved swords and turbans and breastplates, looking extremely fierce and extremely efficient and extremely smart. I remember that. I remember going around Casablanca, going into to the markets. I remember, of course, buying some carpet, probably at an inflated price, but everybody seemed to do that. Well, it wasn't a carpet, it was a small rug. And just generally sort of seeing the sights and sounds of one of these mystic sort of Arabian cities that you don't often see except on film or on the movies.
And what was the Admiral actually doing? It was just a ceremonial visit?
This was, yes, it was part ceremonial, part... It was the sort of thing the Admiral did once every couple of years or whatever it was. He used to go around his patch in the Mediterranean making these calls, because he also had a NATO, he was a NATO sub-commander as well. So he was a double-hatted, if you like. And then where else did we go? I can't remember anywhere else we went while we were down there. We seemed to be quite busy playing a lot of sport, having very good working relationships with the Royal Naval Hospital staff, especially the nursing sisters, and also with the base staff there. Gibraltar was always a pleasant place for sailors to go to. And then after, I think, 3 weeks, we came home.
And was that the end of your time with...
And that was the end of my time with Jaguar.
And when did that finish then? So what's the date you finished?
Well, we're 1976 now.
So was it... Yeah, that's when you joined her as well, or was it?
Oh, is it 76 when I joined. Sorry, we're beginning of 1977.
Okay.
And I went back to HMS Ashanti for a short time in command, but she was still in Reefid.
So you were just purely normal, just there?
So I was there for a matter of a few weeks, really hard worth mentioning. Before I was appointed away, it was the end of my time in command, my first sea command, in 1977, beginning of 77, to the Maritime Tactical School in Portsmouth.
Now, what were you appointed there as?
I was appointed there as the Commander G, the Gunnery Commander or the Gunnery Missile Specialist. Now, the Maritime Tactical School was a very interesting and very well-regarded establishment, and it trained commanding officers in tactics, and it trained not only our own, but it trained RAF, some of the RAF, mainly Coastal Command, some of the army, a lot of NATO commanding officers, or commanding officers designate of ships of frigate size and above, and also some senior civil servants who needed to have an insight into naval operations and naval tactics. It was commanded by a senior captain, and all the staff had just come in from sea command. And so we were supposed to be highly trained and highly experienced. And of course it gave you, during our discussions, it gave you a fair amount of street cred, if you could quote from the horse's mouth. And it involved a series of... the courses lasted about 4 weeks each. And it consisted of a series of lectures, but more importantly, a whole series of tactical games, starting off at fairly simple ones, leading up to quite complicated ones, which were played in a special trainer out there.
Now, tell me about these games. And what was the train? Because the computers were much more primitive then, relatively. I
mean, yes.
How were these games worked?
Well, these games were really, really, the games were to test your thought processes, not so much the practicalities of drill. We had other trainers and other training to do that. But this would give you a situation, whether it might be an aid to civil power, where there was we didn't have them then, but tsunami equivalents, earthquakes, things like that. And you had a force and you had to store it up, get it from A to B, and you had to maintain it at the time. That was a fairly simple one out there. Up to big, leading up to almost sort of war scenarios. which were quite often fought out in the North Sea with you know, implicit Russians lurking about, nuclear submarines involved, aircraft carriers, all sorts, landing forces, projecting power ashore, some of the political implications as well. And all these, you were given the setting maybe a day or two beforehand. You then had you took it in turns to command the syndicate you were in. Each course was divided up into syndicates. You then produced an operation order. One of those was selected to actually play the game, and you then ran it as an whatever it was, admiral or whatever. And then at the end, the staff used to sort of sit. We used to say sit in the pit. This is where you had a battery of instruments to tell you what the various players were doing. They'd all disappeared into cubicles representing ships and aircraft, and you fought this battle out. And then you had a big debrief on the tactical floor. There's a huge floor in the main hall there, which was laid out according to the game plan, and you refought it there, and the staff would then say, not always criticise, but they would say, if you'd have done this, this would have happened, but you didn't, you did that, and so therefore. And it was great. I thoroughly enjoyed it. Had a wonderful time there.
Now, you were doing the course. You were a gunnery specialist.
I had done the course twice before in preparation for my sea jobs, so it wasn't a stranger to me. But that was in the preceding, I don't know, 5, 6, 7 years. And then I appeared on the staff.
Yes, this is what I was confused. You were now on the staff as a gunnery specialist. So that's the course is. Now, what was your role as a gunnery specialist?
Right. Well, I used to deliver all the lectures pertaining guns, and but particularly missiles. I used to do threat lectures, lectures on what the other side might have, mainly Russians, of course, their capabilities, how they might use them, and likewise lectures on our capabilities and how we might use them against a specific threat. And any field of maritime warfare involving guns or missiles, and so that could be underwater, not too much, but certainly on the water, and anti-air above water. That was my specialist, but I then took part with the rest of the staff in monitoring and seeing courses through their tactical games. But you were then the main member of the staff drawn on for your expertise if a particular point pointed towards a certain aspect of it. And we used to go and regard ourselves as the Navy's experts in these, and we used to do, quite a lot of, it was quite interesting, a lot of research, mainly with the intelligence authorities to get up-to-date intelligence on the latest capabilities. And
Russian?
Tactical use, mainly Russians, yeah.
Now, so what happened, anything else you were doing there?
A lot of very good sexual activity. It was out at HMS Dryad, it was, which was the Navy's sort of country home in just outside Portsmouth.
Now, how long were you there for?
I was there for 2 years.
So that's, what, January 77 to...
79, until now, August 79, I think.
Or was it just course after course after course?
We used to go and... you're thinking world events or whatever.
No,
we used to go and lecture.
To you lot, so, you know,
we used to go and lecture at the main army, at the army staff course, Shrivenham, and the RAF staff course. We used to do outside lectures and outside visits as well.
And how did they respond to what you had to, what you had to tell them from outside, being the Navy?
Well, they welcomed us as sort of professionals on a par with them, talking about a subject about which they knew very little. Quite often, almost invariably, on the Army staff courses and the RAF staff courses, there would be one or two naval members, pupils, or students, But they were often specialists of their own right, and they could be fleet air arm pilots or whatever, and they wouldn't have the broad picture. We used to give a broad picture lecture on maritime warfare, and it was good fun and very interesting, and they were always very welcoming.
So that's about it now. So what's that? You'd obviously enjoyed this whole thing.
Very much, yeah.
Was it a good?
We used to socialise a lot with the courses of an evening as well. And it was very interesting to see how the different nationalities reacted to sort of social events. You know, Skittles evenings, eating and drinking. It's good.
Now, so what was this good for your career, do you think? Is it a good career step?
Well, bearing in mind the job I got next, it was a good career step, yes. Yes, it was. It was exactly what I wanted. I did not want, I spent most of my naval career fighting not to serve in the Ministry of Defence in London, and I never did. I went there many, many times to meetings. Now, if you want to get to the top of the Navy, you've got to have done a job in MOD, London, but I wasn't that type of... I just enjoyed being at sea, and I loved the training role, and so I stayed throughout the whole of my career really in the operational side, either at sea or in training or in operational jobs.
Now, what was your next? So this would be January 79, would it?
This was in... It was in the summer of 1979. I was appointed as... a fairly short notice, actually, as the commander of the Invincible. And by commander, I mean executive officer. In other words, the number two.
Now, this Invincible is the aircraft carrier.
Invincible is the aircraft carrier, building at Barrow in Furness, and the commander who had been appointed actually got selected for promotion, and he'd been there for, he'd been standing by the ship building for about 4 or 5 months. And so I went up there as the second sort of incumbent in that particular job. And so I went up to live up in the Lake District for 9 months, standing by Invincible, building a barrow.
Now, what did you actually have to do, you know, as executive officer while they're building the ship, you know?
Well, the executive officer, if I can just outline his role, is, as the captain used to point out often, is a sort of hotel manager. He is the guy who produces the ship in a materially and operational state for the captain to fight. Now, it's a bit more than a hotel manager, but it gives you an idea of the role, I think. But he is also the captain's deputy. If anything happened to the captain and he fell down a ladder or went sick, then the commander would take over command totally. That's it. But his main role was really to keep the ship running and to keep the men occupied, happy, and to oversee all aspects of that. And this was a brand new ship, a brand new concept. So it was very fascinating.
Tell me about the concept of the ship, because a lot of people don't really know what the Invincible is. I mean, they just know it as a ship, but they don't know what the concept is behind it. You're probably well placed to tell us. What was it for?
Well, just very briefly, is way back in... I think it's 70s, it was decided, or Dennis Healy, who was the defence minister at the time, decided that fixed-wing aircraft carriers had no future in the Navy. And so, therefore, he, to cut a long story short, got rid of them all. Now, this caused a fair amount of hoo-ha, because, of course, the fixed-wing carriers provided air cover for the fleet and projection of power as well, which left only the Americans and the French, course, with fixed wing and one or two other countries, but we had none. And we still had a major role to play, particularly in the North Atlantic and worldwide, really, a lot of responsibilities. And there was an inter-service fight, and the RAF persuaded the, I'm being a bit slightly biased here, but the RAF persuaded the Ministry of Defence or the powers that be, the politicians, that the RAF could provide any air cover that the Navy required. Well, they'd done this, where it's always the Navy's claim, by slightly fudging a map that they'd used to put their presentation on, because it became apparent, not very long afterwards, that they couldn't possibly provide air cover to the fleet. And so there then began a course of action, which would, if you like, emphasise the Navy's anti-submarine role, because a number of the carriers had anti-submarine helicopters with them and they were gone. And the threat from Soviet submarines, particularly nuclears, was growing all the time. And so there became a need, obviously, for an major anti-submarine platform that had a very distant water capability, long legs, and could stay at sea and worldwide, really. And because the ship was getting so large, then it needed some fixed-wing protection of its own, because the RAF couldn't provide it. And firstly, we got a ship designed, known as the through-deck helicopter cruiser. The word aircraft carrier was anathema to the politicians, and so they weaseled this newfangled title, the through-deck helicopter cruiser. It had to be called a cruiser because it was so much bigger than any destroyer or frigate, and the nearest was a cruiser. It was much bigger than any cruiser, mind you. And the through deck meant that it had one continuous deck for operating planes. Anyway, this title persisted for a few years, and then it became obvious what the thing was, and people started, you know, it was being called an aircraft carrier, because with the advent then of the Harrier, then we could get an aircraft, a fixed-wing aircraft, that had true anti-air capability and could provide air cover, and also some forward offensive capability against ground targets. And so they realised that we're actually aircraft carriers, and so they became aircraft carriers. They were the first to be fitted with this newfangled invention called the ski jump, whereby some clever naval engineer had realised that although we'd had in the past invented the steam catapult, which is standard fit certainly for the American fleet carriers now and all other carriers, you could actually get extra lift and therefore fly off heavier aircraft at slower speeds if you put a sort of little ramp at the end, like a ski jump. And that's why they all got ski jumps now. And so this strange-looking creature was involved, Invincible was the first of the class. About 24,000 tons. So much bigger than the fleet carriers, half the size almost of the old Ark Royal, well, perhaps a bit more, but much bigger than the average cruiser. So that's how the class evolved. They were going to build three of them, and the first was going to be built by Vickers at Barrow in Furness. And that's how I ended up there.
Now, did they build the other two?
Yes, the other two are Illustrious and the Ark Royal.
So, now, what was the state of the ship when you joined her?
When I joined, the ship was virtually, I mean, they were fitting out. They got to the final stages of the fitting out. The ship was virtually built, had its main engines in, its main machinery. When I joined, they were sort of fitting out mess decks and cabins and putting in the smaller pieces of equipment, doing the furnishings and fittings and things like that. And we were also, of course, the other major aspect was writing the orders and the rules for this brand new ship. So I had never served in a carrier before, aircraft carrier. A number of the other officers had never served in aircraft carriers before. So there was a lot of consulting of old orders from the last of our carriers, Ark Royals and things, on a lot of the organisational aspects. The machinery, though, certainly things like the main propulsion machinery were brand new. It was this was the era of the jet engine, and we had jet engines just like. In fact, we had marine versions of the Concorde engines to propel the ship. So that was all new. So there was a lot of organisational work to be done and writing of orders and rules ready for the crew. Because when I joined, the captain was there. He hadn't been there long. Most of the heads of departments, I think, were there. If they're not, their deputies were there. And about a third of the ship's company were there. So there were, I suppose, about 300 of us altogether.
Now, were you on the ship or were you standing by? You were standing by.
Oh, no. Yeah, yeah. No, there was the ship belonged to the shipbuilders, did not belong to the Navy. So we had no remit on board, and we only were allowed on board by permission of the shipbuilders.
So where were you billeted ashore? Were you in a camp or were you just in...
Well, it was up to us. We were given allowance and told to go off and find somewhere to live. And I found a lovely little flat with the widow of a clergyman in a village called Great Urswick, which was about 3 miles out of Barrow. Glorious, glorious countryside. And we all lived dotted around the place. We used to help for the junior ratings, we'd help them to find accommodation they normally prefer, of course, to live a bit closer to town and the bright lights. But we'd go in every day, and we had a... this is where really my job came in. I was looking after the people who'd arrived there, making sure they had a routine to follow, making sure that they, as far as we could... conform to the Naval Discipline Act insofar as they behaved themselves and didn't sort of rush around the town roaring drunk every night. And generally speaking, made sure that these people were actually preparing for the day when we take the ship away and turn it and take it over.
Now, how did you get on with the captain? Because I should imagine that's quite an important relationship.
It's absolutely vital. The captain was the finest naval officer I ever met. And his name was Michael Livesey. He eventually became a four-star admiral and second sea lord and tragically died very suddenly at the early age of 64.
Now, what was so good about Livesey?
I'd met him before, actually. We were not quite contemporaries at Dartmouth. He was only a year older than I was. In fact, we shared the same birthday. He looked young. I mean, he looked about 10 years younger than his actual age. He was a good athlete. He was fit. He had a tremendous sense of humour. He had endless patience and tact, and he had a wonderful way with sailors. With anybody else, he would listen, and he would join in. He would never impose his rank or authority on you, other than the fact he was what he was, and everybody knew he was the captain. I can't praise the man too highly, it was only right and fitting that he should go as far as he did.
And you fell into good relationship with him. I mean, absolutely, working relationship.
Absolutely, absolutely. I mean, I knew what was required of me, and I used to keep him informed quite often, and we used to see each other every day. And I always made a point of going to see him and telling him, and he always liked to hear the little snippets of. Almost like gossip or scandal, you know, what the lads were up to and what his officers were up to. He never misused those, but he always liked to know what was going on. So I kept him up to the hunt and those, both that and professionally telling him what we were doing. He, of course, had overall charge of the program, and he was the guy who would carry the can if anything went wrong in the end. So we worked very closely, and also with the other heads of departments, and without exception, we had a very, very close understanding with the other heads of departments. I was commander in rank, and we had 8 other commanders, a sort of engineer supply, Wings, who was the commander air. We had a chaplain that eventually became chaplain of the fleet. He didn't join until a bit later. We had a surgeon commander. We had a dental commander. All these heads of departments, all working to produce their own department properly organized and properly kitted out and properly trained. And it was my job to coordinate all this lot. And we all got on extremely well. Now, and interestingly,